Okay, I'd like to welcome everyone to session 132, Rejecting Dogma by Embracing Paradox. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. We encourage you to also purchase other Sunstone merchandise or to make a donation to Sunstone to help support these amazing events. This session is 60 minutes long. We ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for, I think we're going to lunch next, but try and keep on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session, you clear the room and speak outside. Again, I don't think anyone is in here next, but we'll try and keep to the time. So I'd like to go ahead and introduce today's presenter. Jonathan Adderhold practices psychotherapy at Silver Skies Counseling in Seattle, Washington. He is a member of the Mormon Mental Health Association and an active Mormon. Joshua Neal practices psychotherapy at Capitol Hill Therapy in Seattle, Washington. He is a member of the Mormon Mental Health Association and is Mormon-ish. Christ focused his teachings on subverting the letter of the law in order to pursue its spirit. In other words, he pointed us away from the known toward the unknown. Mormonism has evolved into a rigid and dogmatic group dominated by authority. Its members frequently focus on the importance of ideology, often leading them toward moral stagnation and in disregard of others. In this session, we'll explore how embracing paradox and the incomprehensible can allow us to reorient our spirituality to be more in line with Christ's teachings. So that being said, we'll go ahead and turn the time over to Jonathan.
All right. Thank you, Kevin, for that introduction. And thank you all for being here. It's a pleasure to be here at Sunstone again. As was mentioned in the introduction, Joshua Neal is also a presenter with me, but he was going to be unable to attend this one or this session today because he is off in a training in Ireland. So I will be taking the reins today. But I just wanted to let you know that this is not all me. It was a joint effort. I want to acknowledge that. All right. So yes, today we'll be talking about rejecting dogma by embracing paradox. And so I want to start off with our intention. So our perspective is one of many ways to view today's topic. We recognize this as perspective, and it is not the only way to interpret it. So just wanted to establish it from the get-go that kind of like even our perspective is kind of like a form of, you know, another way of looking at things. In a sense, kind of an ideology in unto itself. We are aware of that. But so we are proposing this as one means to looking at it and acknowledge that there are others as well. So first up, let's talk about dogma and what we mean by that. Dogma, as defined by Merriam-Webster, is a doctrine or body of doctrines concerning faith or morals formally stated and authoritatively proclaimed by a church. So, clear example of this, Ten Commandments. These are, all right, I'll just hold it then. Yes, and thank you for speaking up. Okay, I'll go ahead and reread that for those who didn't hear. Dogma is a doctrine or body of doctrines concerning faith or morals formally stated and authoritatively proclaimed by a church. This is defined by Merriam-Webster. And so the example that I've used here, just kind of a clear cut from the scriptures, Ten Commandments, it's a set of rules, principles given out, authoritatively proclaimed by the head of the church, in this case Moses, and it's for the members to follow them. And so another example of this, and one that is not necessarily religious, is IE versus IE, IE versus with a comma at the end versus IE without a comma at the end. Katie, my wife, who helped me edit this, she for her educational background, she worked with the MLS, MSL, yeah, Chicago MLS, which under that structure, you put a comma after the end of IE. I worked with APA, and so there's no comma after the IE. And so those are two examples of a formal, rigid structure in which there are rules. You put the comma or you do not put the comma. And so this illustrates that the tendency towards dogma isn't restricted or limited to religions, but it exists in a lot of our systems and a lot of our the structures within government, law, ethics. The list goes on. Science is a very good example of it as well. Now, to bring it back to Mormonism, though, a prominent example within Mormonism can be seen in the manuals for teaching new members of what it means to be Mormon. The Gospel Principles Manual, if you ever kind of like look at the chapter titles, you'll see a lot of stuff. In fact, I'm gonna open it up real quick. So yeah, you'll see instructional lessons titled "Our Father in Heaven," "Our Heavenly Family," "Freedom to Choose," "The Creation," "Praying to Our Heavenly Father," "The Atonement," "Repentance," "Baptism," "Gift of the Holy Ghost," "Sacrament," "Sabbath Day," "Fasting," "Sacrifice," etc. So these are the way that our church education system is laid out is that. The idea is that we come to be good members, good Mormons, good Latter-day Saints by learning the principles of the doctrine, understanding the doctrine, and then when we understand the doctrine and follow those rules, we will become Christ-like. That is kind of like the idea for which the church education system is supposed to be based around. And the problem isn't so much that this format is incapable of fostering Christ-like individuals, because certainly there are a lot of Christ-like individuals within the Mormon Church, people who find Christ, live his example, and they grew up learning the doctrine and, you know, just following it just pretty by the letter. People are not like I'm saying. It's not that these individuals don't exist, but our beef is that too many individuals are being distracted by the rules, by the dogma, by this knowing that this needing to understand these rules of how to be a good Mormon, and are missing the bigger picture, missing what matters most. And so I want to get into some of those harmful effects so we can understand maybe like why would there be need to change? And I'm sure a lot of you already understand some of these harmful effects. Many of you likely experienced it for yourself. I would assume otherwise you wouldn't be here. So dogma undermines one's ability to push back or question anything. Open communication or disagreements are discouraged and sometimes punished. Good example of this. Previous panel in which they talked about the handbook policy change, and how people are, you know, people who raise questions about that, raise questions about, priesthood and ordained women and other matters that are on people's minds. They raise questions and then there's a pushback from above, from church authority. Next up, changing course is extremely difficult. Good example of this is the priesthood ban, in which African Americans were, people of African descent were prohibited from participating in or from being ordained to the priesthood. And if the religion weren't so dogmatic, then that could have been something that would have shifted, would have been open to a discussion, open to change. It could have shifted a lot earlier than it did, but because instead of being open to dialogue, open to discussion around the issue and why it might be hurting people, instead they tried to explain the reasons for its existence. And so we had a lot of general authorities, coming up with ideas to justify why the ban is still in place and why it should remain so. And so changing course is extremely difficult when dogma gets in the way. Another thing is obedience to authority overrules individual interpretation. And obedience for the sake of obedience is often the result, which I put in parentheses here, blind obedience. For those who are listening to the audio recording, I've included an image here, dogma reel. It's making a dogma appear to be a pill that one takes, and it says, boosts rigid thought patterns for a wide range of beliefs and systems. Reduces independent thought by up to 60%. So a little tongue-in-cheek humor there. All right. Even more harmful effects of dogma, because we're not done yet. Culture of fear discourages speaking out. Speaking out, rocking the boat, or appearing different from the rest. I'm sure all of you are quite familiar with those feelings. And kind of like, maybe when you thought to raise a question, maybe when you're in Sunday school and someone says that, someone says something that just doesn't jive with your understanding of God and God's love. But if you were to speak out, hey, that would be rocking the boat. A lot of members feel discouraged from speaking out because of that. Many members feel anxiety over worthiness and a preoccupation over purity. We see this a lot in the mental health field people who are just crippled by this paralyzing anxiety. Open-ended commandments become undervalued or ignored. Love one another, feed my sheep are good examples of this. Because those don't have like a clear rule to obey, it's more ambiguous, so it gets, you don't focus on that because it's much easier to focus on a rule. That is something that clear and easy to obey. Scripture that doesn't support the dogmatic narrative is likewise underrepresented, such as this year's Sunstone theme. Whatsoever you do unto the least of these, you do unto me. Okay, and yet still more harmful effects of dogma. Because, it's a long list. And even my long list is not comprehensive, but I tried to hit as many points as I could. The big picture is too frequently lost in performing the steps of obedience. So you get caught up, and this is kind of what I was addressing earlier. You get caught up in following the rules, making sure your steps are in line with the commandments and et cetera, that you might lose sight of the bigger picture, lose sight of what it means to live a Christ-like life. Dogmatic narrative can encourages and provides a platform to reject or expel nonconformists due to tribal mentality. If dogma weren't there to designate sinner versus saint, heretic versus devout follower, then there would be no reason to reject or expel anyone. That's another harmful situation, which we find a lot of people who are simply trying to enhance their understanding, enhance their fellow man's understanding of God, of what it means to live a Christ-like life. And since that doesn't jive with the narrative, they risk on being expelled. Okay. Additionally, circling of the wagons. This is a pioneer term, meaning to literally circle the wagons, and what that means is it was a protective, kind of like a turtle stance where you're protected and could see from the outside. And so what I mean by this is that we tend, as Mormons, to sometimes get into the situation where we are isolating ourselves from outsiders, from new ideas and new experiences. So it becomes difficult for us to relate when other peoples don't live the way we do, don't necessarily hold the same values and morals that we do. as members of the church. And so, like, we may feel justified in thinking that they're a little bit less human than we are. Okay, and then that kind of like leads into my last point here, is members can feel justified, shrug off responsibility, or even find satisfaction when bad things happen to nonconformists and those outside of the church. Okay, and the image I included here is a couple of people being burned at the stake, and a guy reading a letter to the church authority. As you suspected, Your Grace, these heretics refuse to embrace the principles of equality and diversity. Irony. Okay, and then, and this is kind of what we get into. Here I've included another image. Christ feeding the multitude, and with the caption of, "I'm not feeding the poor, it only creates more freeloaders." Okay, now I want to contrast this with Christ's example. I could probably like talk the whole session about this, but I'm going to keep it pretty simple and directly geared towards kind of what he was saying about the dogmatic approach. The best exemplified case of dogma during Christ's life was the group that called themselves that was known as the Pharisees, and They had a lot of outward appearance rules and regulations, ways and things that they needed to do that they would project their righteous living by being the ones to follow all these difficult rules, and so and they were very critical of Jesus. Half the things that Jesus was doing, they would be there to gripe about. And so the scriptures contain numerous incidents of Christ rebuking the Pharisees for their insistence on their dogmatic way of living. Contrast this also with the fact that Christ passed time with sinners and publicans being tax collectors, these people were marginalized groups within the society of the time. And of course, the Pharisees criticized him for hanging out with these people. And I want you all to consider the differences in how Christ spoke with these two groups. The first group, the Pharisees, he considered them to be, he said, "Ye serpents, ye generation of vipers," in addition to multiple other things that he said about them. None of them are very flattering. Versus how he spoke to the woman taken in adultery, "Neither do I condemn thee, go and sin no more." It's interesting how Christ like had more hope for that individual than he did for the group that was falling, that got caught up in this dogma, as the Pharisees had been. All right, so now that we've kind of established that, I want to go into what kind of brought us to this point. How did we get to be a dogmatic? How did this dogma get into Mormonism and Mormon culture? So Mormonism, like most contemporary religions, follows a patriarchal pattern. It has a hierarchy of leadership. It has that rule structure with kind of like punishment met out for those who don't fit into it. These are typical of patriarchal societies, governments, etc. To be more specific in the religious sense, God is viewed as a father who establishes order through rule and law and favors his children who obey and are most like him. Now, naturally, the assumption that blessings come from obedience and punishment from disobedience would lead to a dedicated investigation of what the rules are so that they might be obeyed. So when you view God as someone who simultaneously rains down punishment and judgment, as well as the bestower of blessings, and you figure out under this mentality that you live under, this patriarchal fashion, that if you follow rules that God has set out, you will avoid the punishment and secure the blessings for yourself. So that being the case, people were really dedicated to figuring out what those rules are and making sure that they were obeyed. And lastly, we got to recognize that Mormon culture was and is still influenced by Western and specifically American culture. And so with all the wonderful things that came with that, I'm thinking particularly of like the Cold War mentality of gotta protect ourselves from outside influences and watch out for people who don't uphold the capitalistic worldview and gotta keep that socialism out. So that was kind of like a surface level view. And I'm going to dig deeper. I'm going to dig way deeper and go all the way back. Because it's not just Mormon or even religion that is kind of like the root of all this, but it's Western thinking. Now, what do I mean by that? So origin of Western thought lies in Aristotelian logic, named after Aristotle, the philosopher. He came up with three laws that define this method of thinking. First of all is the laws of identity. A is A. Contradiction, A is not non-A, and excluded middle. A cannot be A and non-A. And pretty clear, right? These seem natural and self-evident, and thus tend to go unquestioned. And so, in other words, this is the precursor of dogma. That we kind of think that these rules are natural, that we think that these things need not go unquestioned. That is how it gets started. Aristotelian logic concerns itself with determining objective truth and is the foundation of science. So science has given us a lot of great things. I'm not going to bash on science. Maybe just a little bit. But it's worth noting that that science does have its limitations, and that objective truth can be very difficult to ascertain when we are approaching it from our own perspective, our own worldviews, our own subjectivity. It's hard to define and measure objectivity when we ourselves all see the world differently, and we're going to kind of get into that. So, and I'm going to contrast this with paradoxical thinking. Okay, brace yourselves, because we're starting to get into stuff that might be a little difficult to wrap your head around. And I'm going to do my best to kind of guide you through it. Okay, for starters, A and non-A do not exclude each other as predicates of X. X may be A and not A. What this means is that two things that were excluded under Aristotelian logic need not necessarily be excluded under paradoxical thinking. And we're gonna move into that to kind of help you see some examples and help you kind of understand of how that might be. So first of all, just give some background. This mode of thinking is predominant in Chinese and Indian thinking, and the philosophies of Heraclitus, who was in Greece, and so there was a little bit of that influence, that paradoxical thinking in ancient Greece. Hegel and Marx, who were philosophers that came later, also in Europe. Paradoxical logic is essential for understanding the subjective and helps foster tolerance. Okay. And there is an ancient kind of allegory that I'm going to bring up here. It's the blind man and the elephant. And so I have here an image that demonstrates this. First, blind man is touching the trunk of the elephant and says, "An elephant is like a big snake." Another blind man grasps around the leg and says, "Actually, no, it's like a tree stump." Another one grabs the ear and says, "What are you saying? It's like a sheath of leather." And then the last one, grabbing the tail and the little hair on the end, "You're all wrong. It's actually like a little furry mouse." I think that actually you could fall into the tendency to say that this is a allegory about objectivity. Well, clearly they're all wrong. It's an elephant. But that is not the intention of this allegory for paradoxical thinking. For paradoxical thinking, it's not that they're all wrong. It's that they're all right. An elephant is like a snake on the trunk. It is like a stump in the leg. None of these people who are talking about this elephant, which none of them can actually see clearly, none of them are actually making a false claim. And thus, it is not that they are all wrong, but they are all right. Okay, now we're going to get into some more examples of this. So, Heraclitus, we go into the same river, and yet not the same. It is we, and it is not we. Deep thoughts. Taoist example. Gravity is the root of lightness. Stillness is the ruler of movement. It can seem paradoxical that something that determines how heavy something is can also is also the same principle governing how light something is. Another Taoist proverb, and this one really hits it on the head. To know and yet think we do not know is the highest attainment. Not to know and yet think we do know is a disease. And Christ also used paradoxical logic. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it. And whosoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it. He's literally saying, losing your life will help you find it. And so, sometimes these things can take a while to wrap your head around, but you'll see that these are situations of A not being, A and non-A together, but they're still both true. Paradoxical logic also acknowledges the inefficiency of language to describe the incomprehensible. And this goes into a lot of people's attempts to grasp the divine, try to understand what God is, who God is, even just like who and what other people are, who and what we ourselves are. A lot of these philosophers have come to the conclusion that language in itself, words, are inefficient to actually fully contain these ideas, and that these ideas are not something that we can box in and have in a nice, neat little package. It's very important to recognize that we can't do that with God. We can't do that with being a righteous individual. These things are not easily contained or described or mapped out with words. Eric Fromm, who wrote the book Art of Loving, was pretty formational into some of the ideas that we've grabbed, Josh and I, for this presentation. And so I'm going to read some of his some of the quotes from his book as well. Western theology led to the belief in God as the aim of religious attitude, when it put emphasis on the belief in God. If the person who believed God but did not live God felt himself superior to the one who lived God but did not believe him. In Western religious systems, the love of God is essentially the same as the belief in God, in God's existence, God's justice, God's love. And then to wrap it up on and hit the nail on the head, the love of God is essentially a thought experience. And he and we are both advocating that it needs to be deeper than that, and we're going to go into kind of how we can do that. But before I move on, just kind of like, think on that. Think of what he's trying to illustrate here, that kind of this culmination. We see it in American society. We see it in kind of like conservative Christian groups. Is just like the pinnacle of salvation, that point where you've reached apex, the most you can do is just to believe. Sorry, I'm moving the thing away from it. Is to believe in God. And so he's illustrating that cannot be our apex. That cannot be the goal that like, once we've hit that, we're good to go. We'll go into a little bit more here. Last quote from him: thought can only be thought. So all this talk about thinking we did, and all this talk about logic and the way that we need to think about this, we need to to view this. Thought can only lead us to the knowledge that it cannot give us the ultimate answer. I'm going to put a pause there. And I'm going to read that again. Thought can only lead us to the knowledge that it cannot give us the ultimate answer. The only way the world can be grasped ultimately lies not in thought, but in the act, in the experience of oneness. And so through the act, through this pursuing not just a belief in God, but to experience God, this emphasis leads on the right way of living. Knowledge and right action. So here we want to make this distinction between this type of knowledge. It's knowledge in right action, not in right thought. Not right belief, but right action. Because of this way of looking at things, tolerance is the result, because there is no longer an emphasis on thinking correctly. Okay, and so we see this in kind of like in a lot of the religions of China and India, Taoism, etc. The whole goal of these lifestyles is to lead to the transforming of man, transforming of the individuals who practice it, instead of having a dogma, instead of having a list of rules and things to do. So now that's the theory. Let's move to applying it. So moving beyond dogma. Got a wonderful comic here by Charles Schulz, author of Peanuts. So Charlie Brown is asking Snoopy, or is saying to Snoopy, "I hear you're writing a book on theology. I hope you have a good title." And Snoopy replies, "I have the perfect title. Has it ever occurred to you that you might be wrong?" So, the starting point of any personal application of what we're bringing here today is to start with yourself. Redirecting an entire church or even a congregation is unrealistic. And so when you begin with yourself, then maybe you can slowly start to influence others with your example, with your actions. But don't start with others. Start with yourself. Direct your ethics, which your values, your personal beliefs, direct them inward versus outward. The Pharisees ran into the problem where, and Christ criticized them a lot for this, is that they directed their ethics outward. For them it was important to be seen as holy, even though they were not living as holy. And so practice and live your own values and avoid holding others to your individual standards. Learn, here's a difficult one for Mormons. It's so difficult for Mormons. Learn to let go of certainty and accept what you don't know. Yeah, in a religion in which Mormons believe in that you may know the truth of all things, this is a tough one, but it's important. And the next one goes with that. Hold lightly your theories. Be open to other ideas. Be open, ultimately, to being surprised. As Eric Fromm illustrated, we need to live God, not just believe in him. And how can we live God without knowing God? You might ask. This is a valid question. Raise up. Hey, you know, if the focus is no longer on knowing, well, I'm going to illustrate here before I illustrate it, there's a scripture that you might bring up that's being like, hey, look, check this out. And this is something Christ said. And this is life eternal, that they may know thee, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom thou hast sent. John 17:3. And so this seems to contradict that, well, you do need to know God. But I want to look at the Spanish version, because this helps us understand a little bit more about what that knowing means. And it says here, y esta es la vida eterna, que te conozcan a ti, el único Dios verdadero, y a Jesucristo, a quien has invitado. So the difference between conocer, to know someone, and saber, to know something. This scripture in Spanish does not use saber, does not use the knowledge of facts. It uses the knowledge of to know someone, to know them personally. And so life eternal is not to know about God, but to know God through relationship. The fullest extent of this experience is a oneness with God. And to kind of like move more in that description of oneness, as much as words can describe that, is to live as God would have you live. Live God. Again, words, not the best for capturing these ideas. All right. And going to start kind of wrapping it up here. When asked what was the greatest commandment, Jesus answered and said, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment, and the second is like unto it. Thou shalt love the neighbor as thyself." Some of the people at the time may have expected him to say kind of like an obscure commandment that like, if someone obeys even this obscure commandment, they must be extra holy. But that is not so. Christ instead summarized the whole law in these two statements: love God and love thy neighbor. And I want to leave y'all with the scripture that is the inspiration for this year's Sunstone theme: "For I was a hungered, and ye gave me meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me in. Naked, and ye clothed me. I was sick, and ye visited me. I was in prison, and ye came unto me. Then shall the righteous answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee a hungered, and fed thee, or thirsty, and gave thee drink? When saw we thee a stranger, and took thee in, or naked, and clothed thee? Or when saw we thee sick, or in prison, and came unto thee? And the king shall answer and say unto them, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, ye have done it unto me." And so as it is my exhortation that as we kind of move about our daily lives, as we move about the rest of the Sunstone, that we consider the least of these our brethren, that we consider them and how loving them as our neighbor, as ourselves, how that may be accomplished through that action that will lead us towards a oneness with God, lead us towards living God. And I'll leave you that, and we can go ahead and open it up to some questions. I'll just leave here with your bibliography. Most of the, again, as mentioned earlier, Art of Loving by Erich Fromm. You can look it up if you're curious to learn more. All right.
Okay, we have a microphone up front here, so if anyone has questions, feel free to come on up and ask. Just make sure you hold the microphone real close so it gets picked up by the audio and so fellow audience members can hear you. If you're not as nimble, you can just raise your hand and I'll go ahead and bring the microphone over to you. So we'll take questions.
Not a question, but a quote. It'll be quick.
Sure.
Pursuant to your slide that said letting go of certainty or learn to let go of certainty, a quote I learned recently that I've become terribly fond of: a question mark is just an exclamation point that has buckled under too much certainty.
Oh, I like it. Yeah, and since we do actually have a fairly decent amount of extra time, feel free to not only ask questions, but certainly to make comments. Let's open it up for discussion.
Having the opportunity to experience my Mormon faith for the last almost 26 years, and having recently gotten to a point where in my small rural area I could no longer feel I was being true to myself by attending meetings where I perceived, and I told the bishop, it may just be in the 6 inches between my ears, or 7 or 8 or whatever. Give myself a few inches. But where I perceived judgment because some of my thoughts about who I was to love and who I was to shun were different than the mainstream. If I were to hold up a sign and protest in front of the city hall for a certain political thing, I came to me through the grapevine, and there's a fast grapevine. Oh, those are just the dregs of society. What, they protesting against the government? No, just asking a question. Question mark is an exclamation point under too much pressure. And so the choice that I had was to kind of remove myself. This was for my own sense of health, to remove myself from the fray. And the handbook, which in some ways I interpreted a little differently. And one of my friends, all my friends are LDS, and pretty much from my wards, as I've split and split and split over these years. And I love Jesus, and I love the gospel. But the dogma, the rigidity at the level with which I was dealing, and I asked to be booted upstairs, and I felt a lot more of the spirit that I was looking for, fortunately, in this one instance. But all I'm saying is that I have chosen to completely back off for the time being. I did not say I don't want to be a DNC. I did say, out of love for me, please don't get in touch until we move. I get settled, because a lot of stuff is going on in our lives right now. But to make a long story short, people keep telling me how much they miss me. And yet my very, very dear friend, who has lived in that town all of her life, never really gone outside of it very much. I have other friends, too, who have not been so isolated. She looked right at me, bless her heart, and her face was contorted with fear as she looked at me and she said, but Roberta, she said, you watch out because Satan will get his grips into you. And the look on her face and the action of her hand was just like this. And I said, Rosie, I know Christ long before I came into the church. I knew the Spirit long before I came into the church. And it was just like, I can't deny all of those feelings. And so I feel okay. And I feel as if a great burden lifted for me, for now. And if it's only the perception in my head of the judgments that come down one way or the other, I haven't been excommunicated or anything, I just withdrew. And I feel great about it. And if my friend, I said, please don't worry about me, but if you want to worry about me, I mean, everyone can use prayers for their soul, but I'm very happy right now. And when the time is right, I will probably become involved again in a new location where the surrounding population is not quite so isolated. And boy, all I've learned in my Mormon classes are you are going against, you know, I mean, all the things that have been said to me that I've learned over the years, and I've learned so much. I think the ideas of the church are, wow, have problem with some of the doctrine. Anyway, I'm going on too long. I'm wandering. I'm sorry, but I just want you to know that I'm so thankful for places like this and for people like you who are open-minded. And there are a lot of good people out there who have moved away to get away from the weight. Thank you.
Other questions?
Yeah, thank you, thank you. And just kind of like to add an additional comment to that. I felt that was a pretty good demonstration of what kind of Eric Fromm was saying when, just kind of like that comment about like knowing Christ before you became Mormon. I think that really illustrates that kind of like what Eric Fromm was saying, the person who believed God but did not live God felt himself superior to the one who lived God but did not believe him. And that kind of like, you know, just like that stopping with that belief, that kind of like if you haven't converted Mormon, if you haven't been baptized, like that you don't experience God's love, you know, obviously not. And so I think that was a wonderful example of demonstrating that. Thank you.
Yeah, hi. I enjoyed your talk very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'd just like to suggest that I think something that plays in here is simplicity versus complexity. And when you have a simple system,
yeah, absolutely agree.
It's very possible to have completely subscribed to beliefs. As it gets more complex, that becomes more difficult because there's been a great deal of research in the last few years into chaos theory, and we know complex systems begin to involve chaos in a productive way, but then not everyone is on the same page. Lots of questions are being asked, and so on and so forth. When you have such complicated matters as the theology and the teachings of, the Roman Catholic Church, of Martin Luther, of modern Mormonism, is it really possible to approach it as if it were all a simple thing with a set of dogma to which everyone subscribes? Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I think, a pretty good example of that is to kind of like look at Christ's as, because he did enter the scene during a, you know, particularly dogmatic time in the Jewish faith. Jewish faith perhaps, in a lot of other aspects has not been as rigidly dogmatic as it was during Christ's time. A lot of the philosophers that I read come from a Jewish background. They're very open and open to paradoxical thinking. They're open to different ways of viewing the divine. I mean, and so kind of like the Jewish faith of nowadays doesn't kind of restrict it as much as perhaps it did in Christ's day. But yeah, and so like Christ entered this time, all these rules, all these dogmas that, you know, people are saying do this, do that. I kind of think about like when Christ was asked, okay, so what's the greatest commandment of the law? He summarized that. He simplified all the law from the Old Testament into just love God and love thy neighbor. Simple. And if people lived that, I believe that they would come, that you would have a straighter shot at living God, at a straighter shot at living a Christ-like life through that approach than getting caught up in all the dogma, getting caught up in all the rules. Thank you for that comment.
Yes, I'm not sure where the comment came, but when we end this life and we go wherever we're going to go and meet whoever's going to meet us, the question won't be, what have you done, but rather, what have you become? And that, I think that's from Fromm, I'm not sure, but I love that.
Yeah, I could certainly see him saying that. Even in my presentation, the words don't adequately capture, and that's why, like, I actually like the phrase live God as opposed to maybe like, you know, live a Christ-like life. Because, you know, that living God, that does have has an action of doing as well as a becoming, all kind of wrapped in a phrase, live God. And so, yeah, I agree, kind of like that becoming is definitely important. Book of Mormon talks about a mighty change of heart. I didn't bring that into this discussion, but like, and that's one, you know, that's some of my favorite scriptures from the Book of Mormon that talk about this mighty change of heart that in which the people have no more disposition to do evil. And when you have no more disposition to do evil, you don't need a long list of don't do this, because you don't want to do evil. You don't want to hurt people. And so, yeah, becoming, having that change of heart, it's important, yes.
I think what you've really talked about is powerful, and it is my personal belief and truth as well. As a professional, I look at organizational systems, however, and the Mormon Church is a very distinct and powerful organizational system. There's many ways to change things, but systems create culture, and the culture seems to be one where we are moving away more into this dogma sort of culture than one that is really based upon what I would believe is the true religion of Christ, what he taught. What is your vision of change in relationship to this on a larger scale than the one-to-one, you know, the personal?
Yeah, that's definitely a good question, and you know I have to kind of like avoid feeling discouraged when, you know, thinking about the monumentous task that it would be to shift a culture, shift a church's ideology, but you know, even though I said start with yourself, and I still say that, really start with yourself. But you know, keep yourself from being overburdened with trying to change everyone. But if you feel that you're in a good place, if you feel like you can start, that you can branch out and maybe like try to influence things. I mean, like really, I brought up at the start the way that the Mormon Church teaches its new members is through these lesson manuals, which go on a bullet point list of all the things that you need to know in order to be a good Mormon. I would like to bring in that simplicity that our other brother talked about here. Maybe we can simplify that down to some core points that maybe if you want to keep the bullet point list, fine, but these core points, I want them in every lesson. I want love thy neighbor and love God in every lesson. Never lose sight of that. I want that mighty change of heart in every lesson. I want a transforming in every lesson. Do I think that this is the only way to look at the only solution? You know, definitely not. I hope that there's people putting pressure. Those of you who are not inside the church, I think it's important that you put pressure from where you are, from being outside the church. Those of us who are inside the church, I feel like we need to do our part and kind of like speak up when we can. Speak up when we're able to. You know, kind of try to illustrate to others the better way. Try to illustrate to others through our example that love of God that can best be summarized not in kind of a bullet point list of laws and rules, but a transformation, a new way of living, and so, yeah, definitely a good question. I certainly don't have the answer. This is simply my take on it, and I hope that all of us can kind of like start to bring new ideas and how maybe we can do our part to make the change we can. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I'm his wife. Hello. One of the things that we had a great opportunity to do is we actually taught the new member classes in church. I don't know how they gave us that gig, but they did. And so we were able to take that very, you know, not simplistic, but that very, you know, like, learn this, the bullet points, and expand upon that. We were able to take our callings and use them in a way that we felt and that the Spirit guided us to do. And so some of us are in situations where we aren't given callings where we can actually influence anything because they want to keep us quiet. Not that I'm speaking from personal experience. But Yeah, in that Gospel Essentials class, we were able, in Gospel Doctrine, we were able to take, you know, the word of wisdom and really dive into that. We're from Washington. Marijuana is illegal. Let's talk about how that applies to the word of wisdom. And, like, really just open up that conversation, like the part about, you know, prophets will never lead your congregation astray. And we were like, yeah,
it says that in
asterisk.
The manual.
Yeah, we're like, huge asterisk there, like forever. We're like, forever. They will not lead us astray forever. People are like, oh, that's a really good point. So, like, taking advantage of it, and it wasn't anything that we weren't standing going, like, you're all idiots. Like, come into the light. It was just like, here is another presentation, making it as inoffensive and as non-confrontational as possible, but taking advantage of those opportunities that are given to us in the structure of the church to just open up the conversation even a little bit, even if it's not just me standing up being like, I'm a proud bi Mormon woman and we're going to talk about the policy change. It's just like, hey guys, this really hurt me and my friends. Like, that is such an opportunity that we have.
Yeah, thank you. And yeah, and Katie just reminded me of a point that I can make to also Josh and I, we presented together last year at Sunstone, and our topic was a discussion of what's not up for discussion, in which we talked about having these very difficult discussions around people's, we use the term absolutism, which kind of like talked about taboos, talked about stuff that people don't want to talk about. And so we talked about how to have those conversations. And so kind of like a little plug to go check that out from last year. A discussion of what's not up for discussion. It's the presentation that Josh and I gave last year. All right. Any more questions or comments?
Time for about one more if anyone wants it.
Short thing.
Short. Okay. Buckminster, in the woman who spoke about the power of the church and the organization and all and what is seen in the future, you know, nothing is standing still. It only appears that way. And Buckminster Fuller, he said something like many, many years ago, you've got this big ship, whether it be ship of state, ship of the church, ship of whatever. And if the rudder is adjusted just a little bit, just a millisecond of a degree, if you can use those things, if they're compatible terms, if not, just wing it, that immediately you cannot see the ship change direction. But as you trace the geometric line out from the ship, the angle becomes wider and wider and more open and more open. And it's a living church. And new people come in. Different kinds of people come in. Different. This was a cradle. And so anyway, I just wanted to say that it's a living church. And I have faith and confidence that in the arc of time, if we're all true to ourselves, it'll move in a direction that perhaps some of us who are having more trouble now might find more appealing. The spirit moves.
Thank you so much. And just kind of to echo that. If we get discouraged in the here and now, keep our perspective on the long goal. It's a long game. It's got many phases. It's not over yet. So don't lose hope.
Okay, I'd like to thank everyone for attending. That was really great. Let's close with one final round of applause for Jonathan.